That's a very important bit, Barry. A little bit earlier, Barry pulled my leg, and I'll tell him straight away that I've got a record number of slides, so we'll see whether we can get through them all or not. Can you all hear me at the back? Good. Right, that's what I think of as a typical Beatle. Not everybody does, but there are strong arguments to support that notion. Thought I'd put that up. I'm one of the troubled, the disturbed, and I'm sure that a lot of my colleagues from the second floor who are here today share that with me. That's what most people think, perhaps apart from the very bright colours, as being a more typical beetle. It's more beetle-shaped. So it's my concession, having started with Staphylinid. Anyway, this talk aims to set the scene for what we expect to be several lectures on beetles in this Insect Natural History series. The number of talks to follow is as yet indeterminate, but we can expect at least two. Chris Lyle has volunteered one on weevils, and I expect to do one on staphylinids, or staphylinoids, later on. We may well include others on the terrestrial edaphaga, hysterids, aquatic beetles, ladybirds, whoever we can nobble and comes up with an appropriate suggestion. Anyway, clearly one introductory talk can't begin to do justice to such an immensely successful, varied and ubiquitous group of insects as the beetles. To kick off, I'd like to show a series of slides, very quickly, not of beetles, but of opportunities, ones that beetles have seized over evolutionary time, emphasizing those that they've seized with the greatest avidity and the resources garnered by them that potential competitors have not been able to manage an equal share of. Mountains, forests, grasslands, I won't bother to try to focus that. More cool, almost boreal grasslands. Forests and the treetops, the moist tropics. Rivers and exposed sediments on their banks. Reed beds. Extensive bare sediments, again in a cool environment. The same sort of thing in close-up. Sand, bare sand, the seashore, right down to the lowest, the low tide level and beyond. Freshwater ponds, algae in great mats. The seashore, piles of kelp. Dead wood standing and fallen. Termite mounds. Ants' nests, there is one in there, a former Carufa nest tucked away all around the log. Fungi, smaller fungi. Mosses, very small organisms, diatoms in this case. Dung, at last a few beetles. And another one, and even more. Focus that just a little bit. This is one of Frank Krill's slides. I can't seem to get all the beetles in focus. Never mind, you can see there are plenty of them. Sorry to go back one, I missed one there. Carrion, again, lots of beetles. Smaller bits of carrion and a few beetles around it. A dead, largish millipede. Maggots, Diptera larvae. Mites, mollusks. Okay. So I don't know if I stand here where you can all see what's on there. I've got a few overheads that I'll put on from time to time, sometimes at the same time as the slide over there. So beetle opportunities and resources. You've seen some pictures. Here's a list of some others, some of the ones you've seen, emphasizing those that beetles have few competitors in using the resource, and sometimes no competitors at all. I'll just pick on one or two of those. Apart from the hemipteroids, freshwater, invasions by adult insects, really it comes down to beetles. When it comes to social insect nests, beetles are overwhelmingly the dominant inquilines, represented there by many more species, in fact, than the social insects themselves. Slime molds. Diptera as well, but beetles are probably the primary denizens of slime mold fruiting bodies and primary feeders on them. There are not too many parasitoids in the Coleoptera, but they're scattered right through the order, as we will see when we get round to phylogeny. And there are parasitoids of Orthoptera, Coleoptera, Hymenoptera, Diptera, also Hemiptera, Cicadas, and so on. There are plenty of kleptoparasites. And perhaps one unusual thing about beetles is that kleptoparasites are often very closely related to the species whose resources they're nicking. And there are some ectoparasites of mammals. So the main categories of beetle food can be seen as falling like that. There are other invertebrates. Although it's little documented, I believe that microorganisms, apart from small fungi, are much more common food of many beetles than is generally supposed, including ciliates and soups of all kinds of other things, including bacteria, and also small algae. Fungi, a very important resource. Living green plant tissues, of course, wood, which is not essentially living, and decaying plant and animal matter. When it comes to being a carnivore, then beetles are particularly strongly represented as predators of those groups up there. Here's one of the specialist Colembolin predators, a sort of frog look-alike, if you like. Shoots out that mouth parts by hydrostatic pressure, sticky bit on the end. So I think you'll see here. Yes, so bottom right, number 42. It's a very sticky sort of surface. There, essentially frog-like adaptation. And this particular group has got some couple of thousand species in it. And among the other types of major types of food, there are many more, I think, nematode predators than perhaps are generally recognized. Snails and slugs are occasional, but scattered right across the order, and rivaled there perhaps only by flies amongst the endopterygotes. I've already mentioned protistans as being a much more important source of food than perhaps is generally supposed. And also, of course, the food extends to many other groups. Small vertebrates, some big water beetles can be pests of fish farms, eating small fish. One or two carabids actually eat frogs. I won't go into details. Many adult insects are eaten. Many larval ones of other groups, fleas in bird and mammal nests and so on. And plenty of other arthropods, especially spider predators, isopod predators, and the species that graze encrusting organisms in freshwater, such as bryozoans. Before moving on, I would quickly make the following point. Very few beetles fall into those categories. There are, in fact, parasitoids in some dozens of lineages, just in the carabids alone. In the ground beetles, there are seven or eight different lineages in which parasitoids are found, and in some cases exclusively the species of parasitoids. But there are relatively few in that category, unlike the Hymenoptera and many of the Diptera, and unlike the hemipteroids, there are virtually no plant suckers. There are suckers of fungal hyphae and of fungal juices. One whole family of beetles virtually specializes in that, with somewhat derived sucking mouth parts. Plenty of beetles feeding in soil, but not on soil itself. So we might conclude reasonably that as jacks of nearly all trades, beetles have cracked it. And in doing this, this is a separate point, they've dealt in what I regard as a brilliant manner with the indirect threats posed by the uncertain tomorrow and the direct threats posed by the extremes of their physical environment. Wet, dry, cold, hot. And they also have many effective means of dealing with direct biotic threats and with competition. That briefly summarizes those points. Anyway, to move on, what this talk could be about. It could be about lots of different things. I could stick for the rest of my time here to a be amazed approach, one which might go down well. I'll try to throw in a little bit of that. I could deal with beetle phylogeny and classification. That would keep me busy for the whole talk. I could deal with the question of why are there so many different kinds, and just how many are there anyway, and how do we work this out? I'll scarcely have time to mention that. I could deal with ecological patterns, with the size and composition of assemblages, a subject near to my heart, but again, I'll have to skip by that one. I could deal with beetles as biological model systems and applied tools. I could deal with them as organisms of economic importance. I could take as guide Roy Croson's monumental work on the biology of Coleoptera, some 800 and something pages, published in 1981 as a guide. In there, there are 21 chapters, and there are special chapters devoted to subjects which some of you might prefer me to talk about. Cytology and genetics, development and life cycles. There are 3 chapters on adult and larval morphology, 3 chapters on physiology, and so on. Or I could deal with a range of special topics, such as those. They all might be entertaining in their own way. I had to throw that one in, the picture I came across. I'm not going to talk about mimicry, but that's a remarkable looking longhorn beetle, believe it or not. And I'll leave it to you to judge what it's trying to be. It's in the right sort of setting. Unlike most longhorn beetles, this is running around in sandy places and burrowing in the ground to some extent. And there's plenty of behavioral and postural mimicry in beetles too. A lot of it also involves smells, involves sounds, and so on. This is a desert dwelling, or dry place at least, dwelling tenebrionid beetle in a characteristic sort of pose with its tail up in the air, lots of noxious glands at the back end, enough to put you off. It is, in fact, a tenebrionid beetle, but it could equally well be a cerambycid. I've got pictures not as good as this of cerambycids, which look exactly the same and do exactly the same thing in exactly the same places. Beetles that live in termites' nests sometimes go to extraordinary lengths to chemically mimic their hosts. Perhaps one of the most extraordinary cases I know of is where the termite in question is known to have 21 different cuticular secretions. And the Aleocorine staphylinid beetle that lives in its nest is such a good chemist, it makes all 21. I think that's quite extraordinary. This one, apparently, is trying to look like a youngish termite by the development of its abdomen shoved over its back. Okay. Before moving on yet again, I would like to address one or two what I call accepted wisdoms. Like any other subject where the effort is to reach conclusions and achieve a rounded view that makes sense from all perspectives, the subject of how to be a beetle, what makes beetles tick. When you're dealing with this, what you come up with will depend to a great extent on where you start. So in looking at the patterns exhibited by the Coleoptera in nature, it's worthwhile getting as sound a perception as possible as to just what these patterns are. This may seem a very obvious point, but there are a number of accepted wisdoms with respect to beetles that just don't seem to go away. Along with a few serious misconceptions and some out-of-date ideas or facts and figures that get trotted out and colour, if not actually determine the conclusions reached by some who are all too ready to provide explanations for Beatles' successes. So let's get the patterns right as we can before starting on explanations. Explanations are cheap compared with the hard graft of gathering reliable data, which may explain why much of what is written about beetle success and beetle diversity patterns in the ecological and evolutionary biological literature, I'm not knocking you, is not up to too much. And seemingly, the more high profile it is, the greater the tendency for it to be rather shockingly misleading. So I want to deal with a few of these matters, principally four: beetle size, how many species are there, where are beetles mostly found, and what do they mostly do, but in a pretty summary fashion. I shan't have time to fully explain and justify, say what my data are, where they come from, but you'll just have to take some of my conclusions for face value. Make of them what you will. So body size. The general conception of beetle body size is a bit out. Beetles are smaller than most people think. Roy Croson noted many years ago that that if you take the whole range of beetle sizes, and you see there in this particular figure, we're going from about a third of a millimeter, that's not clear, but a third of a millimeter is about the bottom whack, getting on for the size of a small, very small Hymenopteran, and at the top end, well overlapping the size of small vertebrates, birds and mammals and so on. And Roy looked at that size range and noted that the geometric mean was between 4 and 5 millimeters, and he supposed that the mean body size of all beetle species would be in that same sort of range. In fact, it isn't, but you still see figures like that and figures of 3 to 4 and so on used. It's clearly somewhere between 2 and 3, so a good bit smaller than you might reasonably expect. But have a look at that graph simply. It's a couple of data points. I do have more. One of them derives from a faunal list for a completely inventoried area, pretty well, the British Isles. Another one for a large area, Sulawesi. Very similar sort of shape curves. But notice, as well as being reasonably smooth, even though the scale at the bottom is logarithmic, it is a little bit left shifted. And that's interesting. And every single pattern of body size distribution, a major group I've ever looked at, is of a similar shape. If you pile them all up together, you get one again of a similar shape, and the various things that we could conclude from that. That's, if you like, a modal beetle. It's a little derodontid, between 2 and 3 millimeters long. That's your typical beetle, not some of the ones we'll see in a minute. And what I was saying about this left shift, so that the mean body size in most groups is a little bit left even of the geometric center, probably answers Bob Mays, this is one of his figures, his question mark there. This is based on described species, and he wondered whether, in fact, the dip down to the left on the left-hand side was an artifact, or whether really the line would just go on straight up. Well, I think the answer to that is it does go down to the left. Of course, you can cook the results in this respect by choosing an appropriate size class at the left, which makes it into a straight line. If I'd done one for beetles, which was 0 to 5 millimeters or 0 to 3 millimeters, I'd have had a straight line for beetles. And people tend to forget simple things of that sort. Anyway, moving on to the second topic, how many? Anybody who's experienced gathering or looking at large samples of tropical, particularly moist tropical forest beetles will know that the majority of them, when you get them back, are undescribed. We've dragged this slide out time and again, but it's still the best one. Martin looking at acres of beetles, including lots and lots of undescribed ones. Well, the general sort of conception as to how many described species of beetles there are, the sort of figures you see in the literature, even by the most notable of writers, the Ed Wilsons and so on, you'd get the idea that there were somewhere between 250 and maybe as many as 350,000 described beetle species. It's a figure of mine produced several years ago and copied in a Danish journal by a colleague. And you see the beetle bit is down the bottom right. and it represents something like a quarter of the total, including all the plants and fungi. So when you see comments that describe beetle species represent a fifth or a sixth of all known animal species, you know you've got it wrong. It's well over a quarter, and possibly nearer to a third. My latest count, I won't tell you how it's been made, but it's largely a count from scratch, and it's about 75% complete. Gives the current figure for described species accepted as valid at 417,000. And the weevils haven't been dealt with properly yet, and I guess they're underestimated, so that number can be expected to go up a little bit. How about the rest of them, the undescribed ones? We know that the existing record of description is very biased. We know sorts of ways in which it's biased. It's biased by the accessibility of species, both geographically and otherwise, by what I call their apparency, whether they occur at eye level, whether they're obvious, whether they have some economic interest, whether they're easy to catch. Sometimes a sort of philatelic interest is responsible for particular groups being well studied. And there are a series of other factors involved. But anyway, the record's biased, so it doesn't help very much. We know the real answer in terms of how many species there are about involves different proportions of different groups from those that are in the record. Some groups clearly are very underdescribed. There's just a few of them scattered around. They're mostly small, but not all that small. And they include some interesting things like the Mordelids, for example. A group which recent work in the tropics has shown to be massively underdescribed. One could add a few other largish groups to that. Anthribids are a possible case, and a whole range of smaller groups. Anyway, if you do all the appropriate totting up, and again, this is something I could indeed have given long talks on, how you go about making the best possible estimates of how many left there to describe, you may come up with an answer like this. My best bet is that the various beetle groups vary in the main between ratios of 2 to 1, to that is undescribed to described species, and 10 to 1. There are some cases where as many as 80 or 90% of species have been described, but these are mostly small in terms of species, well-known groups such as tiger beetles, stag beetles, and so on. And I think there are some cases where the ratio is likely to exceed 10 to 1. But the big players, the ones that are going to make the biggest contribution to the total overall, seem likely to lie in that 2 to 1, 10 to 1 range. And if you top them all up, something like a couple of million comes up as your answer. Put it like this. If I had the real answer sealed in a sealed envelope right here, and you bet me that there are less than a million beetle species, I'd take your money. If, on the other hand, because top whacks are much more difficult to be sure about, you bet me that there were definitely less than four, I'd have to think about the odds a little bit more carefully. But around about two or so is a figure on which lots of different approaches converge. And here's just a quick comparison of some of the largest beetle groups in terms of described species as they stand. There's only half a dozen which pass 25,000 in terms of described species. And just a brief comparison of what the picture might look like when you've got them all in, a slightly different order. And some have crept in which from nowhere to being 10K plus, including the Mordelids, Malarids, Adirids, various other groups which weren't on the previous list. And of course, when I say 30K here, some of these are going to be, certainly the first three, are going to be a factor of several times in excess of those totals. And even groups such as the Carabids, the Scarabeards, and so on, are likely to be well over 30K rather than just over. Okay, moving on to the third question in terms of accepted wisdoms. Where are most beetles found? temperate to tropical ratios undoubtedly vary tremendously right through the animal kingdom. And beetles, I expect, on various bits of evidence, again, I won't have time, having checked my watch, to go into details, I expect them to be at the high end. Not very different from some other insect groups, Endoptera groups such as the Lepidoptera, perhaps rather similar to the Hemipteroids. But I'd expect the ratio of species to be found in the tropics to those in temperate areas to be notably higher than is the case for the other two mega-diverse groups, the Hymenoptera and Diptera. So that's one conclusion. There are various situations where temperate to tropical ratios are undoubtedly low. Freshwater inhabitants in general. Dung exploiters, low-ish. I know that there are many groups that are particularly tropical, but if you would take them as a whole set, the Staphylinids, in the case of beetles, the Hysterids, the Teleids, as well as the Scarabeards and so on, then I wouldn't expect them to be near the sort of beetle mode, which I would think should be around the 5-to-1, 6-to-1, area for area, and site to site level. Perhaps in the range 5-to-1 to 8-to-1. Unlike the sort of figures which generally are mentioned in the literature on the basis that beetles ought to be like the best known groups, the birds, the mammals, and the flowering plants, in which such ratios are undoubtedly very much lower, of the order of 3-to-1 in plants and nearer 2-to-1 in mammals and birds. So where are they? Beetles are pretty well everywhere, but there's an awful lot of them in the tropics, especially the moist tropics. Of course, there are lots of counterexamples. I know of at least 100 beetle groups of tribal rank or higher that show very weak or what is known as reverse latitudinal gradients. Here are just a few of them. You could pick out many more. The Carabids as a whole, a weakish gradient. The Helipalids, a reverse one. These ones with stars on are clearly reversed. Most of them are not represented at all in the tropics. Even the Coccinellids, relatively weak. Roger's here, he can argue me about that one. And some very obvious weak gradients in some quite big groups like Elaterids. That tends to be paralleled by similar sort of similar gradients in elevational terms. Just go back one. And, well, why? Why do these patterns differ between different groups? Here's a very simple graph which perhaps says it all. You see the small degree of correlation between the proportions. This is at the country level in Africa for various well-known groups. The swallowtails are butterflies, of course. And you'll see that plants in particular are notably atypical. Plants, unlike most animals, are able to dig for their moisture. And beetles, like most insects, are as much influenced by the distribution of moisture as they are by temperature and various other things. So the brief explanation for these is that, in my view, beetles will be much nearer this sort of pattern across vastly greater numbers. I don't have the figures. Perhaps a little bit more extreme even than swallowtail butterflies, but certainly nothing like the plants, which are massive in southern Africa, in the Fynbos and other areas where beetles are not quite so big, and relatively low in tropical Kenya and Ethiopia, where beetles, and I think most organisms, in fact, particularly the microorganisms, follow a different pattern. So one final point about where. Something that we are still blessed with in the literature is the, and certainly in the public, sorry, I'm going to focus that, in the public conception, is that the answer lies in the treetops, the heart of biotic diversity, and so on. Well, I won't go into that. There's plenty of published work now that's come out in the past 10 years that is available, which presents evidence of a very conflicting kind. And to the best of my knowledge, there remains no actual evidence to support the notion that there are vastly more species in the treetops than on the ground. It's the other way around. Treetops again. Never mind. Just a couple of slides from work in Sulawesi some years ago just to make that point. The black bits basically are treetop specialists in all these samples, and this lot are the specialists at lower levels, basically ground levels, across the major superfamilies. And it's easy enough to find plenty of examples where it's even more extreme. In the caraboids, for example, most of the edaphaga groups, sizable groups like the hydrophylloids, scarabioids, effectively no specialist species in the canopy. The few that are there are generalists or wanderers from lower levels. Nearly everything's down the bottom of the forest. Right there. That's the typical sort of place where most beetles ought to be. So let's start with where and what do they do? Just one particular accepted wisdom. I want to have a quick go out there. This is a typical sort of view of, in this case, insects. This German entomologist, Hans Simon, has spent decades gathering brilliant stuff, gathering data from the literature. He doesn't make his own judgments on it, so I'm not blaming him, but this is data from, you know, from various sources. And he's done very similar ones for all of the separate orders of insects, working out through the whole of the described taxa what proportions do this and that. And 65% of insects, he says, are phytophages. His figure for beetles actually is 71 point something. But again, what can I say without going into great details? These figures are simply plain wrong. They seem to derive from originally from a paper of Peter Price's back in the 50s, where he made some rough and ready calculations, and that's been misquoted. And then by a Chinese whisper process, it's gone up and up and up until you've reached the point where, instead of the original statements that perhaps approaching half of all insects were associated in food webs that had something to do with plants to a situation where you got figures of this sort. And of course, these are based on described species. And if you accept that the biases in the previous descriptive effort that I've been talking about, and they do seem to be illustrated by big samples, big inventories of nature, are valid, then the proportions of herbivores amongst all the undescribed species are going to go down even more. And these are just some typical figures showing what the situation in general might be like for beetles, and in a tropical and a temperate setting. And you'll see that the herbivores are down here well under 20%. I think on average they could be a little bit higher than that globally, partly because this Sulawesi figure is a single site figure, and herbivores scale slightly differently. That is to say, slightly better represented at larger scales than at small scales, and I think that can creep up a bit. But the basic picture is clear. Lots of predators, more fungivores than herbivores, and lots of saprophages, and unless you include dead wood feeders in this category, lots of those are a separate category too. So there are fewer herbivores among the beetles than we might think. Say 20% or so. Right, let's start with some of these accepted wisdoms. Just a couple of seconds to look at beetles. That's purposefully vague, that picture, so I don't have too much to say about it. I won't be tempted. It's, again, a typical beetle, staphylinid. But for those who are not familiar with beetles, just a couple of points. The prothorax in beetles is well separated from the rest. The mesometathorax, often regarded as being a single unit, the pterothorax, that's the typical setup, with the pronotum visible on the surface, just in case I use these words later on. Part of the mesothorax is represented by this scutellum, that's the visible bit, which comes between the wing cases and goes right underneath. The wing cases are right there, the elytra. I won't refer to anything much else apart from the mouth parts. Beetles have very generalized mouth parts. There's usually a very distinct mandible, often for chewing in various ways, sometimes with the base of the mandible differently arranged for grinding things, a molar lobe and so on, and a full set of, pretty full set of mouth parts. Not as full as in the crustacea and so on, but antennae, side maxillary palps, labial palps, the labium here, and hypopharynx and so on. So a pretty sort of generalized setup. There are lots of variations, of course, but that'll do for the moment. Adult beetles. Larvae and pupae, immensely variable in form. One of the problems in defining the order is finding larval characters that will distinguish all beetle larvae from all megalopterans, neuropterans, and so on. But this, if anything, is typical. This sort of very active, long-legged, in this case predaceous larva, is fairly representative. Again, distinct antennae, in this case seizing as well as chewing mouth parts, a bit like those you do get in Neuroptera, in fact. Longish legs, urogomphi, not cerci, which come from down here, but outgrowths of the ninth segment, there, the abdomen. Three distinct thoracic segments. Pupae can be what they call exarrate or obtect, that's to say, more or less bare without any sort of soldered over covering, like many Hymenoptera, or obtect, more like the Lepidopteran condition, or various conditions in between. This is near the X-ray end of things. Note the sort of long spines, lots, and the legs stuck out to one side. Lots of beetle pupae do this in one way or another, largely because they sit in a pupil chamber and they want to keep themselves away from the edge to stop themselves getting wet, moldy, and so on. So, lots of larvae are very different. There's a almost legless cerambycid larva. It does have small legs underneath. They look in lots of different ways. Oh, I put this one in for Martin. I've got time just to go quickly onto it. He came up with a story from Nature this Monday, which I frankly didn't believe, report that the trianglin larvae, these little things of certain Meloid beetle in North America, went in for an extraordinary performance. I don't know if anybody's heard it, came across this apart from people on the beetle floor. A couple of American authors, and they got the paper in Nature, so I don't know if it's a spoof or not, found that basically these things line up on flowers. They're tiny little things, hook claws, and they turn to this sort of larva later on once they get into the bee or whatever it is nest that they're going to. So they wait for the Hymenopteran, usually a bee or a bumblebee, to turn up, and they grab onto it. But in this case, not this particular species, but the one that's being talked about, these things apparently assembled in thousands and formed themselves in the shape of a female bee on the flower. So that when males came along, they decided as a female bee, and they went down and descended on this lot. They all immediately grabbed the male's chest hairs, and when the male disappeared, they all went with it, and then when the male went to mate, which is a fairly usual sort of thing, they got off onto the female. Well, I won't say any more. It seems there are some extraordinary tales on the BMA's front, but that's the BMA's decide for the moment. Right, quickly on to classification. Here's a nice slide that Alfred Vogler lent me. Wow, look at it. This is only part of the picture. This is the Polyphaga, the main suborder of beetles, the one with the most species. And resolved down to, you know, relatively fine level. Each one of these nodes, 228 taxa there, is something that's been looked at for molecules. This is a molecular tree. A few funny little bits in it, but some very nice resolution of a very well-defined group, the Cucugiformia here, interesting placement, the Eucinetoidea down here, and the Litteriformia. A very interesting diagram. But I will float on from that to another slide Alfred lent me, which he calls a traditional view. In fact, I'd use one much more like this for doing everyday sort of comments on attributes linked to these various groups. Four suborders. We don't really know for sure how they're related. It's one of the big open questions. I've got an overhead I will put on here, which I will leave on for a little while. Just a scribbled one, which gives a slightly different arrangement. I put the Edaphaga with the Mixophaga. Archaeostomata, the oldest and most conservative suborder. Very few species around still, but there were lots of them. Mixophaga, an odd little group. I'll show you a picture in a moment. The Edaphaga, the first real big triad being a beetle, and then the Polyphaga, the rest of them. Well, I won't dwell on that, but I will move smartly on. And we'll exchange that overhead for this one. How does all this fit into the sort of fossil record and the evolution over time. There's a nice, sorry, Jurassic scene. Not much in the way of angiosperms about. Tree ferns, some conifers. But effectively, as you may glean from looking at this overhead here, by the mid-Jurassic, virtually everything had happened beetle-wise. Everything was there. All of the major groups, and I haven't written the names on the top, but they're the same names as on the previous diagram. Here we have the Edaphaga, the Myxophaga, the Archostomata. Here, all of the Polyphaga, where that black line is. And reading from left to right, going from the Skirtoids or Eucinetoids through to the Curculionoids at the other end. So at that sort of time, most of what really was going to happen to beetles had already happened. And certainly by the time you got to, this is sort of mid-Cretaceous, lots of flowering plants around. Sorry, let's go back one. Things are pretty much like modern times, beetle-wise. Even though, as you see from over here, the ants had yet to really emerge as a dominant force. Ants here doesn't mean the first ants, but what you might call the rise of the ants, roughly round about there. You can take that or leave it. And these other things, first lizards, first frogs, potential enemies of beetles, birds again. Termites, a big opportunity. Angiosperms, another opportunity. Placental mammals, another big opportunity. Dung, nests, carrion, all the rest of it. Right. Now, I'll leave this up here. No, I won't. I'll replace it with the one that's got some scribbled names on. So you may remember what ADEF stands for. And at this point, I'll do a calculation to see. Right. I'm behind by a bit. So I was going to run through a whole series of beetles, and I would do no more than name them. I will not say anything about the attributes. If you know what they are, you can shout them out. Join in the fun. This is the only slide I've got of a Myxophagan. And I will simply say that it's probably the first aquatic group of beetles to arise. Little hydroscaphid larva pupa. So let's just rattle through them. And it's going more or less from top to bottom on this diagram. A ground beetle, an Edaphagan, a parasitoid, Brachinus. Another Edaphagan, a highly modified aquatic one, a whirligig. A Skirtoid, very long annulate antennae, the larva of in fact, a Skirtid, aquatic. A Buprestoid. Buprestids, yes, there, Buprestoids, right, all the names are up there. Another well-protected and consolidated beetle, an Elateroid, an Elaterid, in fact. Another Elateroid, an Eucnemid, very well protected again. One of the soft Elateroids, a Cantharid, soldier beetle. In fact, two of them. They're usually in that position. I once saw 49 on flowers in Pennsylvania, and there were 24 pairs in cop and one left over. And I thought, well, that's remarkable. I felt very, very sorry for them. They're also known as the Randy beetles. A Lycid, another soft Elateroid. Softish. Extraordinary larva of one particular sort of Lycid. That's a be amazed one, known as trilobites. Right, the rest of them are just coming. I will try and adjust my timing. Okay, good. We'll rattle through these. A typical staphylinid, staphylinoid. A less typical staphylinid. Some staphylinids have long elytra, don't forget. Also long necks in that case. Fungus-eating one. A fairly typical, more primitive scarabeoid. A psallid, big chap living dead wood. A leucanid, another relatively primitive one. Note that the wing cases are relatively long. We'll be back to that in a minute. A more derived scarabeoid, cockchafer, Melolonthine scarab. A nice, somewhat bee-mimicking higher scarab too. And another, Cetonian, rather bright colors. A lot of them have very fancy colors. A higher, if you like, scarab. And still working way across, another large group of aquatic families find themselves in the Biroids, Biroidea. Here's the larva one, known as water pennies. This is a siphenid. The adults are seen much less often than the larvae. Larvae sit on stones, in streams. A Limexelonid, one that always leaves his wings hanging out. Doesn't have anything much to protect it. Sorry. And in the cleroids, you just saw very quickly a clerid. And a softish cleroid, a Milarid here. It's a different sort of softish beetle. And we'll come up against another kind of softish beetle in a minute. Cucurgoids come in all shapes and sizes. So a lot of them are little round beetles. Here's some little roundish ladybirds all assembled on a stick, a British one. Different sort of ladybird, larva. One of the, I think it's one of the Phytophagus ones. Roger will know. Is it Epilacnine? Yeah. An Eretilid, a fungus beetle, still in the cucurgoids, and its larvae and pupae. Another sort of fungus beetle, an Endomycid. Nice colors, again, feeding on large fungal fruiting bodies. Moving into tenebrionoids, one of the hard, crunchy tenebrionoids. Plenty of those in tenebrionids. A slightly softer one. This is one of the more delids. Many of them are stem borers as larvae, but some feed in rotten wood and on fungi and so on. A different sort of soft tenebrionoid. That's one of the Milarids sitting on a flower. Another softish one, wings somewhat exposed there. That's an Edomyrid. It is a pyrocroid. Another softish tenebrionoid. And moving to the Chrysomeloids, one of the probably more derived ones, a tortoise beetle. There's not much to it under all that. The body's much smaller. Another one, this is an asparagus beetle and its larva, different sort of chrysomeloid. Larvae of another chrysomeloid doing their typical thing, eating leaf surface. And another group of chrysomeloids, the cerambyses, colorful ones like that. And big larvae, almost legless, but not quite. There are legs under there. And some strange ones like this, the harlequin beetle with its great long legs in the male. And finally, the caculinoids, one anthribid, fungus feeders in the main, and one proper weevil, many of which are plant feeders. I won't do any more of those because Chris will give you a whole talk on those later on. And just one weevil, larva, and pupa. Again, in this case, legless, and again, with bits sticking out to arrange itself in its pupal chamber. Right. Rapidly on. I've two topics I want to deal with before I close. And I've got just a few minutes. And they're the most important bit, of course, left to the end. I'll take that down. Right. So what's so special about beetles? What are the possibly enabling mechanisms, those that enable them to make quantitative leaps to move into new avenues and so on, ones which enable them to deal with competitors, all these biotic and abiotic threats I was talking about, to resist drowning, to resist being infected by diseases, to resist excessively hot and cold temperatures, predators and so on. Well, crunchiness has to come pretty near the top of the list. And there are many different ways of being crunchy or horny, if you like. You call them horny beetles. That's possibly ambiguous. And it's probably already clear to those of you who know me that I tend to think of insects as problem-solving devices. And the problem is to identify what the problem is. As Roy Croson said, most of historical biology and we're dealing with a historical subject, it's reductive in the sense that you have what appear to be solutions, and what you've got to do is sort out what the problems are that these are the solutions to. Anyway, adopting this rather circular approach, but nevertheless very fruitful approach, I think it's possible to sort out that beetles who were running around in those Jurassic and Cretaceous forests, and even right back in the Protocoleoptera in the Upper Carboniferous, they were making, like many other insects, a good job of running around in what are known as substrate zone habitats. As adults, they had a problem of getting damaged, wet, dirty, also predators, but particularly getting damaged by going through substrates. And they weren't alone in that. Lots of other groups faced that, and the blattoids got themselves fairly protected hind wings. The Hemiptera weren't around at that point, but eventually they did too. And of course, there's the well-known example of the earwigs, which have very effectively covered their hind wings and also shortened them and have a fancy mechanism for tucking the wings away. Not a very good one, I would say, in some ways, but a fancy one nevertheless. Anyway, your average beetle, here's a big one. This is a Chilean lucanid of an odd shape, Charles Ignathus. You'll see that the wings are longer than the wing cases. Well, how does it manage that? It's like many other insects, it reduces the effective size of the flight wings by a folding process. Many beetles do it by doing longitudinal folds, sticking it over the abdomen. Some have a little bit of apical take-up. Even some Hymenoptera do that. Certainly there are plenty of other groups, including blattoids again. Even a few Lepidoptera tuck their wings up a little bit. But most of them don't do it quite in the same way that beetles do, with the single exception of the Hymenoptera, as I say, which do something rather different. So you could say that the problem for beetles, and the one they found a solution to, is they've developed these things, the elytra, as a means of protecting the flight wings, these rather delicate things, and also to some extent the abdomen underneath. But it's not as simple as that. If you're a big beetle, the size of wing you need in order to be able to fly, if you're that sort of body shape, is roughly 1.3 times the length of this shape of elytron. These are various water beetles, and these are real figures. If you're more medium-sized, then it goes up, and if you're small, it goes up yet again. I won't go into the details of why that is. In other words, being a small beetle, you need to have bigger wings proportionally, and therefore tucking them away is a bit more of a problem. Also, should you want to change your body shape and become shorter and rounder or whatever, you've got more of a problem. Beetles solve this by going in for a variety of fancy folding mechanisms. This is what William Forbes, the Lepidopterist, said many years ago. He was working on, for a break, I think, beetle wing venation. And he suddenly discovered back in the 20s that, goodness gracious, the venation actually correlated with various ways of folding the wings. He never worked out how they managed to fold the wings. He imagined all kinds of things. He didn't watch them alive very much. He supposed that they might be using their legs to tuck them away and so on. But he became very interested in the folding patterns. And this is one simple one. William worked out hundreds of them. I did a lot back 30 years ago, but I won't dwell too much on that. Anyway, the convention here is that the red bits are the bits that are down, facing downwards when the wings are folded. And this arrangement here is a cunning one. It works as a little hinge. Everything turns around that. This is a very simple spring-loaded device. I'll knock on. In a spring-loaded device, this is in this case, this is one in a tiger beetle. You have a moderately strong spring, and this works automatically as soon as you take pressure off the wing to fold it away. But most beetles don't do it that way. Most beetles go about it in a completely different way and use external agents to fold the wings. And the natural position of the wing when it rests, if you cut it off, for example, it springs out. It needs to be held folded under pressure. There are many different fancy ways of doing this. This is a brief cartoon of one way of doing it in a sylphid beetle, a pretty extensive reduction of wings. And this is the way they do it. It just surprises me still that nobody actually worked out how this was done until I had a look at it some 30 years ago. And in parallel, at the same time, a young German student, noted a number, not all of the same points, but people just hadn't twigged. There's a ring surface, lots of little tricky. Sometimes they're more concentrated in patches. That's the business gubbins with which wings get folded. On the abdomen, you have these special spicule patches, sometimes big, sometimes smaller. This is a staphylinid where there's a well-sclerotized membrane in between the segments. Sometimes the spicules face inwards. Those are actually pointed inwards towards the midline. Sometimes this is a malariid beetle. Similar sort of ones point outwards. That correlates with a different method of folding. Sometimes they're highly modified. These are the smallest of all beetles, teleids. And instead of standard wing folding patches, they have these nice little things here, which mesh with, there's one more close up. These are very old pictures, but they're still okay. Meshes with these little hooks here, and possibly also with the hooks that are on the largely feathery wings, a bit like a bird's feather. Sometimes there are extra fancy adaptations for holding the wing in place during the folding process. And here's one in the wing of, this is in fact an edifagon. An interesting thing is that both wings have this structure. You may think it costly, wasteful, but it's fairly random in many cases whether the left wing goes over right or right over left. There's the thing in close-up, and that meshes with, a bit like Velcro, something on the underside of the elytra and holds things in place. And that's the sort of stuff that's on the underside of the elytra. So you get lots of nice little setups involved with this. Anyway, if you don't have a decent wing folding mechanism, this is what you're lumbered with, being that sort of shape as a beetle. Not too bad, works very well. There's a large buprestid. Or like the coelotherid. And you don't vary very much from that. It's a conservative body plan. This is an old slide, but basically it tells the story. If you have a moderately successful folding mechanism, one involving a spring or not particularly strong spring, then these are your choices. You can stay how you are and do quite nicely. You can lose your flight wings, in which case you don't have to worry about your wing cases. You can expose them, like some of those you saw in pictures earlier, like the limbic psyllids, or you get a higher graded wing folding mechanism. Here's one that's opted out. This is a cerambycid from high up the tree. It's a chrysomeloid, but it's gone back, which is opted out. It decides it doesn't need to protect its wings. In terms of actual mechanism, these are the pathways or the more explicit choices. The primitive beetles have simple springs. You can get a little bit further. These percentages are the amount of wing you can fold up, the extent of the wing you can get tucked away. And you can, by adding a little bit, you can go as far as 40%. You can get a complex spring, which is precisely what's happened in the edefaga as a whole, sometimes with a little bit of extra help. Same thing's happened in the scarabeoids. Or you can go the whole hog and go for a really fancy folding mechanism where everything is all external push. And you can also go for getting it under a very small elytron, and this gives you much greater mobility, not just in staphylinids, but in virtually all of these other groups here. There are examples of taxa where wings have got very short, but wings are still folded. Wing cases have got short, but wings are still folded underneath. And this enables you to do fancy things like this, go around corners and go in and out of lumps of things. Right. So I'll work through rapidly to conclusion. Missing out further comment on that. To make my final remarks. So having another look at beetle success, if we leave out the two major hyper-successful radiations, that's these two, the staphylinoforms and the cacujiforms, that's where it's all about in terms of numbers of species, diversity of lifestyles, and so on. Beetles are not so remarkable in an endopterygote context. They are much like some of the moderately successful but not hyper-successful groups. But Beatles' super success today is basically the success of the two hyper-diverse lineages, the Kikujiformia and Staphylinoformia. You could say there have been trial runs at being successful beetles in these terms. That's my last overhead. And really, there are sort of, in How to Be a Beetle, there are four sort of ending up points. You can be a super beetle. That's these really big, crunchy ones that tuck everything away. They protect their, not just their flight wings, but they protect everything. Predators can't get at them. They have fancy joints, rim-fold joints. They have ball and socket joints. They have very thick executable. They're very hard. You can't get a pin through them if they're in the collection. Very difficult to pick up. Very difficult to pierce. Highly protected. And also very good in desert situations. Very good at resisting desiccation and so on. Or you can settle for what I call sub-beetledom. That was some of the softer beetles you saw, the true soft beetles, the ones that were originally soft, and some of the ones that gone secondarily soft, but still looking pretty much like beetles. Or you can be hardly a beetle at all, and there are examples right across the order there of beetles that seem to be trying to be flies, or trying to be fleas, or trying to be something else. And they've given up on all the things that really make beetles this great success, or one of the things. Or you can go for the mainstream. And the mainstream, these two big hyper-diverse groups I'm talking about, I think the Arcus thermata might have been a good try. The fossil record's not good enough to know just how successful they were, but there aren't many around now. I think the Edephaga certainly was a good try, but I think they're all already over the top and going down the other side. But with perhaps 100,000 extant species, they're doing not too badly. And the same applies to the Elateriforms. I'll finally go back to this thing again. So you can see where they are. The Elaterids and the other groups in that area, Dasyloides, Beroids, and so on, the Elateriforms. Probably 100,000 of those too. But they are early attempts, if you like, at going for the mainstream. And they're not the real bee's knees. Anyway, cutting right through to the end, a final comment about herbivory. Oh, it's just some of the other correlates of beetle success. Of course, apart from the structural integrity, and in particular the protection of flight wings, this gives rise to a long adult life, the possibility of adults co-occupying larval habitats. You're free to do what you want. You can get into the substrate zones. But a negative characteristic is probably the other most important one, one that enables beetles to be adaptable, flexible, and so on. And this successful approach is what explains to me why so many beetles eat plants and eat fungi and so on. And the idea that beetle success can be explained in any reasonable sense by the existence of any particular opportunity or resource seems a rather strange idea. The amount of resource available clearly has a lot to do with what happens. Beetles are in a position to take advantage of these because they are successful animals. They're not successful because they eat plants or fungi or dung or something else. I've run over time, so I'm stop right there. No, with the abdomen and elytra together, the abdomen being the active agent, the elytra holding them in place. There are one or two that play with their legs.
Do they move the elytra as they're doing it, sort of pushing it over?
Yeah, I do have models, but this room's too big to show them, so I didn't bring them along. I mean, models of beetles, you know. and basically, it's the ventilating movement, probably, that they're using. So, which is used for, you know, getting air in under the wing cases to the spiracles and so on. So there's your wing case, there's your abdomen, and the abdomen sort of rises, meshes with the wing and moves forward, unmeshes, goes back. It does that sort of thing. And each time that Velcro, not actually Velcro, because it meshes easily, stuff joins, they're able to push. And so you're sort of pushing it down, just like that, sort of pushing it, that sort of thing. The high-grade mechanisms that enable them to reduce the length very well, no, I think not. The real constraints and problems are perhaps with the moderately good mechanisms, particularly the ones based on strong springs. This involves so much change to wing venation, wing structure, compromise, if you like, that there's no way forwards from that. You've got what you've got is what you've got. You can't take it any further. And there are three or four different major groups. I mentioned the Defiga, which have got very, you know, sort of reasonable mechanisms. And there's nothing wrong with it. They work fine. And they can top them up with a little bit of fiddling and pushing. But it does mean, because of the compromise of the wing structure, that you've got nowhere to go. So the answer is no, it's not a problem in the obvious immediate sense, but in the conjectural problem-solving, evolutionary, psychobabble sense, then yes, it is a problem in my view.
Pete, any 3 million years of evolution, 350,000 described species, why have none of these reached the same high social organization at some kind of
Good question. They haven't got the genetics for it. I mean, there are peculiar genetic setups in some beetles, just one or two, like Micromalthus and so on. You could say that they don't need to. But no, frankly, it's a question I couldn't answer straight away. You'd have to think about lots of ifs and buts and choices and so on. I mean, there's some obvious correlates of being eusocial, but maybe somebody else can answer that one. Somebody working on social, Chris
so
can.
The eusocial,
where
the
yes, yeah,
exactly. Takes up the task of the subdominant thing
next to the work. Yeah. There are, and there's the hysterid, the odd ones, but they haven't taken off. They're not sort of ruling the world the way that termites and ants and so on are. I put money on both. In fact, I did have a final paragraph that talked about just that, but I missed that out.
Peter, could you repeat the question?
Right. The question was, in the event of a nuclear, was it a disaster? What would I put my money on, a beetle or a cockroach? And my answer was both. I think beetles are very much today's men and women, or whatever you want to call them, in the sense of these hyper-diverse groups, but I think lurking in those mainstream groups of beetles, there are also tomorrow's insects. I can well imagine a situation where the world has changed drastically, not say by the sort of disaster you mentioned, but things do change, ecosystems change radically, where certain even quite major insect groups have run out of a job to do. Their trade has disappeared, if you like, and they've had it. I don't think that would happen to all beetles. I think there will be, as I say, species, robust, well-protected, mainstream beetles lurking there who would take the opportunities of tomorrow. As far as cockroaches are concerned, I think there's a good chance they'll carry on doing what cockroaches have done for a very long time, which is not as many different things as beetles, but they might well still be there doing it.
Beetles that don't fly, given the complexity of wing popping, given the advantages of elytra, get the impression that a lot of beetles have given up flight altogether.
but perhaps that's a totally false impression compared with other major groups of insects. Would you care to comment?
The question was about, we probably got it, did you, from down there? About the importance of elytra and loss of flight and so on. We don't have precise figures, of course, but the most recent serious review of wing polymorphism grossly underestimated the frequency of partial or complete loss of flight in beetles. Probably, if I had to guess, amongst the endopterygotes, beetles will come first in terms of proportion of species that are totally flightless, lost the ability to fly, not just wings, but muscles, even sclerites and so on as well. Quite ancient loss. Difficult to put a figure on it. I did try to work out in certain faunas how many species were wing polymorphic at one point, and for temperate faunas came up with a figure of 6-7% for beetles. That's a lot of beetles. Now, I suspect it's a little bit lower in the tropics, but even so, if you've got 2 million beetles and say 2% of them are wing polymorphic, then that's what, 40,000? Is it? I can't do the calculation quickly. And if a slightly larger proportion are totally flightless, which would be expectation, then that's an awful lot as well. But they do keep their wing cases, largely. Not all of them. There are some, those that live in mole rats' nests, for example, in the middle of Africa, lose everything. They don't just lose their wing cases, their wings, they lose their wing cases, they lose their eyes, they lose, and they end up looking like a bit like beetle mole rats, if you like. But yes, lots of beetles keep their wing cases as part of a structurally integral system for protecting the abdomen and everything else, typically in deserts, in fresh water, obviously, where you have a subelytral cavity used for different purposes. In deserts, it's used for cooling. The elytra themselves are used as a means of reflecting heat. Many subsidiary uses for elytra, even as an advertising hoarding, to get back to your butterflies. Beetles don't have butterfly wings, but they have nice elytra they can put messages on. So they're used for lots of different things. But the structural integrity and the protection of the flight wings are two separate but linked themes, which take a while to develop. But the patterns that are illustrated by the relative occurrence and where they occur, those phenomena, have a lot to say about the value of those particular things and also about beetles, about what makes beetles work. I can't say more than that.
Are there any neophytic beetles? Are they become sexually mature and with a larval morphology?
Yes, quite a few. One BMH thing I had up my sleeve, which I could have mentioned, is the micromalthids, supposedly Arcus dematans. One species, very tiny, very soft. I think it holds the record for the number of different larval types in one life history. There are nine different types of larvae in a single life history. That is haploid males, and the life history involves pedogenesis, it involves parthenogenesis, it involves viviparity, etc., etc., and the various other groups where there are larvae form females, and even larvae that are able to lay eggs and so on, scattered around, notably in the Elateriform series.
Time maybe for one last question. If you're about to go on to the desert island, you can take one speech a week.
Ooh. Perhaps I can answer that over a drink, Martin. That's a tricky one.
So, please, on behalf of us all, thank you so much.
Thank you.